So I'm going to be talking about some recent work with David Poland and Philip Koss. I may at the end mention some other work with various other people working on the conformal bootstrap. Let me start with an example of the kind of thing that's starting to come out of the conformal bootstrap. So this is a plot of allowed operator dimensions in 3D CFT. The x-axis is the dimension of some scalar operator sigma, and the y-axis is the dimension of epsilon, which you should think of as sigma squared. It's the lowest dimension scalar in the sigma-sigma OPE. And what this plot shows is an upper bound on the dimension of sigma squared as a function of the dimension of sigma. So the region in white is disallowed, and the region in blue is allowed. So if you read this plot, suppose you have a CFT, and it has a scalar operator with dimension 0.6, then the lowest dimension scalar in the OPE of that scalar with itself has to have dimension less than whatever the corresponding point on the curve is. And to make this plot, all we have to assume is that we have a theory which is conformally symmetric in three space-time dimensions, that the theory is unitary, and there exists a scalar operator sigma. That's it. That's very general information that goes into this plot. And the amazing thing about what happens is that the plot has a feature, this kink, and as well as we can determine, there is a theory that lives exactly at the kink on the plot, which is the 3D icing model. So there's something special about the 3D icing model. Just from these basic assumptions, we find that it's the theory in three dimensions that maximizes sort of the anomalous dimension of phi squared compared to phi. And this is pretty amazing. These are very general assumptions, and we're learning something about operator dimensions in a theory that is strongly coupled, where we don't have any good analytic techniques for systematically computing all the operator dimensions in this theory. The best we can do are Monte Carlo simulations and the epsilon expansion, which works pretty well but is non-rigorous and definitely breaks down at high enough loops. So this is great. This kind of plot is very tantalizing. These bootstrap constraints somehow know something about non-perturbative conformal field theories. So this is one of the main motivations for going forward. And one of the questions that we'd really like to understand is, why does a theory live exactly on the boundary, or as far as we can tell, exactly on the boundary of the allowed region? And under what conditions can we learn about other CFTs using these techniques? So a natural class of theories to look at beyond the 3D icing model are ON models in three dimensions. So the 3D icing model you can think of as the critical fixed point of phi-4 theory in 3D. And the ON model is pretty much the same thing. You just have, instead of a single boson, you have n bosons, and you add a phi-4 potential that respects the ON symmetry. And these theories are interesting for a number of reasons. Firstly, we have a better handle on them than we have on the icing model at large n. We can use large n perturbation theory and do systematic Feynman diagram computations of all the operator dimensions. Similarly, there's an interesting story about how they fit into the ADS-CFT correspondence. There's a conjectured higher spin gauge theory that's dual to the ON model at large n. So there's a lot we know at large n, and we can try to compare large n results to bootstrap results. Meanwhile, at small n, these theories are actually interesting for experimentalists. For instance, the superfluid transition in helium-4 is described by the O2 model, and there are various magnets described by the O3 model, and various other condensed matter systems. So there are actual experimental measurements of critical exponents in ON models that we can compare to. And one of my favorite stories about this is for the O2 model, which describes the superfluid transition in liquid helium. This is one of the best studied critical points experimentally because of experiments that were done on the space shuttle in 1992. So up here on the right is the phase diagram for liquid helium. And the superfluid transition is on this vertical line between the superfluid region in the lower left and the normal liquid region. And the way you probe it is by adjusting the temperature and measuring things like the specific heat capacity and other observables and seeing how they behave as a function of temperature. And you can see there's also some slight pressure dependence for the shape of this line. So if you try to do experiments with liquid helium on Earth, there is a pressure gradient due to gravity in your system. And that will broaden any measurements that you make. But if you do the measurements on the space shuttle, there's no pressure gradient, and you can get very precise plots of the behavior of observables with temperature and measure critical exponents of this theory. So the O2 model, because of experiments done on the space shuttle, is one of the best studied critical systems in condensed matter. And the error bars from these experiments are comparable with the error bars that I'll show you later in the talk coming from the conformal bootstrap. This is an obvious class of theories to be interested in for a number of reasons. And we have some experience with bootstrapping theories with ON symmetry in four dimensions. And the experience shows that the numerical techniques that we need are somewhat more complicated than the traditional techniques, traditional in the sense of that they've been used for the last few years, applied to the conformal bootstrap. We need an algorithm called semi-definite programming, and I'll say a little bit about what that is. So we've applied semi-definite programming before to learn about theories with global symmetries in 4D. And there we needed some very specific results about four-dimensional conformal blocks due to Dolan and Osborne. So to apply this algorithm in three dimensions, we need an analog of those results for conformal blocks in three dimensions. And that's one of the key new pieces of technology that is input to this work. And I'll talk about that. So here's an outline of the talk. I'll start by reviewing the conformal bootstrap and how we use basic axioms of conformal field theory to put bounds on operator dimensions. And then I'll talk about this new technology we need, which are rational approximations for conformal blocks. And then I'll present results and talk about future directions. So are there any questions before I proceed? OK. Great, so all right. So the starting point for bootstrap analyses is to consider a scalar operator in a CFT, a scalar primary, and look at the four-point function of this scalar. So we can evaluate the four-point function by pairing up operators and doing the operator product expansion between them. So there's some expression which says that a product of operators at separated points is equal to a sum of coefficients times a function of the separation times an operator at one of the points. And this is a sum over operators in the theory. Using this operator product expansion between these two pairs, we can express the four-point function in terms of a sum over squares of these coefficients. We get one coefficient for each OPE times functions called conformal blocks. These are functions of conformally invariant cross ratios, which just depend on the distances between the various points. And the conformal block is completely determined by conformal symmetry in terms of the dimension and spin of the operator O in the OPE. So this is decomposition of the four-point function into clear kinematical information, which are the conformal blocks, just fixed by the symmetries, and dynamical information, which is the OPE coefficients and the actual dimensions of the operators in the OPE. An important piece of information for us is that in a unitary theory, if our scalar phi is real, then these OPE coefficients lambda are real. So the coefficients in this decomposition are positive. So to evaluate the four-point function, we had to pair up the operators to do the OPE. And we could have paired them up in any different way, and we should get the same answer, because it's just a four-point function of bosons. So this leads to the constraint of crossing symmetry. And that's basically the statement that the sum of our operators, where you do the OPE between 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, is the same so as the sum of our operators when you pair up 1 and 4 and 2 and 3. So the stuff on the right-hand side should equal 0, except that I've decided to isolate the unit operator from this stuff on the right-hand side and put it on the left-hand side. Okay. So the top line is just the statement that OPE gives the same answer no matter how you pair up the operators. In equations, it looks like the second line. To go forward, I'm going to write it in this schematic form where we have the contribution of the unit operator on the left-hand side and then a sum of positive coefficients times things that are determined by conformal symmetry. Okay, so this is the form that we want for the crossing relation going forward, and this is just the statement that you can do the OPE any way you want to evaluate the four-point function. Okay, so how do we get information out of this equation? The key constraint that we need is positivity of these coefficients. Basically, we'll find, so on the left-hand side, we have the contribution of the unit operator, which is fixed, and we know it. And the question is whether or not we can reproduce the unit operator using these f functions with only positive coefficients. And if we are constrained as to which f functions we can use, then we might not be able to reproduce the left-hand side with positive coefficients. So there's an efficient way to get actual numerical results out of this idea. It's this procedure, this algorithm on the slide. So the first starting point is to assume something about the spectrum of operators that can appear. And just as an example, let's assume that all scalars in the theory have dimension greater than some delta min. So let's say all scalar operators have dimension bigger than 100. Subject to that assumption, you try to find a contradiction. So our goal is we assume all scalars have dimension bigger than 100, and we try to find a contradiction to that, which would tell us that can't be true. To prove a contradiction, we try to find a linear functional acting on both sides that is negative on the left-hand side and positive on the right-hand side. To get positivity on the right-hand side, all we need is that it's positive for each possible term that could appear on the right-hand side. And then even though we don't know the OPE coefficients, we know that they have to be positive. So that means that the whole right-hand side is positive. So the procedure is make an assumption, try to find a linear functional that satisfies these positivity conditions. If we do, the assumption is wrong. And then change your assumption and repeat. And in this way, by making different assumptions, you can map out the space of allowed assumptions and disallowed assumptions. OK, so that's pretty fast. So are there any questions about the procedure? I imagine there are questions. So would it be helpful for me to give a very quick example on the board? Yeah, good. OK, so maybe I will. So as an example, And this is just a nice exercise that was done in the original paper that presented this method by Rotazzi, Richkoff, Tony, and Vicky. So what you can do is look at these, plot these f functions. So I'm going to pick a particular line in conformal cross-ratio space. So these f functions are functions of two variables, u and v, but I'll pick a single one-dimensional subspace for that space. So there's a variable z that goes from 0 to 1, and u is z squared, and v is 1 minus z squared on this subspace. And if you just plot these f functions, they have some nice simple shape. So the left-hand side in these coordinates with the right conventions, the left-hand side is just 1. So our goal is for a bunch of things with positive coefficients to add up to 1. So the f functions for high-dimension scalars look kind of like this. And so this is L equals 0 and delta big. And similarly, for high spin operators, they have kind of the same shape. So let's say this is L equals 2, 4, 6, and so on, any delta. And then the f functions for low dimension scalars look like that. So this is L equals 0, delta small. So one way to simplify all this information is to apply a linear functional to this picture. Namely, just look at the second derivative at the midpoint. And you can see that most of these functions have positive second derivative at the midpoint. We're trying to sum up to something that has zero second derivative at the midpoint. So that's impossible unless we also have functions that have negative second derivative at the midpoint. So if we assume that all scalars are big, then we can see just by looking at the second derivative at the midpoint that there's no way for these functions to sum up to 1 with positive coefficients. So if you assume all scalars are big, then this second derivative functional gives you a contradiction. And there's some crossover point, some critical value of the dimension, where this behavior changes, and you know that you need a scalar with dimension less than that critical value.
So what fixes this critical value?
The critical value depends on delta phi. It comes from, so I've actually suppressed the delta phi dependence. Let me go back slide. So these f functions are just this stuff here in parentheses. And you can see that if you fix delta phi, then you can just start plotting these functions. And they're, once delta phi is fixed, they are determined by conformal symmetry. In 4 dimensions, they're just basically hypergeometric functions. And you can plot them and see where the crossover value is. OK? So that's the bootstrap algorithm. What I just did here is this algorithm where in the second step, I only looked at a particular kind of linear functional. I just looked at the second derivative at the midpoint. So I could have done a lot more. I could have considered the value of these functions at different points. I could have considered derivatives, many derivatives around different points. And you can try to run the same argument. So the general argument allows you to look for any functional that could rule out your assumption.
Okay.
All right, so the middle step is the hard one. And it's an example of a convex optimization problem. So once we've made our assumption, we have the task of finding some linear functional that's negative on the left-hand side and positive for a bunch of when acting on a bunch of other functions. The reason it's a convex optimization problem is you can think of it as, say, minimizing alpha of minus f unit subject to a bunch of linear inequalities on alpha. There's one linear inequality for each delta and L. So each linear inequality restricts you to a half space of the space of linear functionals. And together, you get an intersection of a bunch of half spaces, which is a convex space. But anyways, so we have this optimization problem that we have to solve. And it's very similar to something called the semi-definite program. The difference with the semi-definite program is that here, we have this condition alpha of f delta L is bigger than or equal to 0. And this function that can appear here is some complicated conformal block that depends on delta and L. And in general, it can vary in some complicated way depending on delta and L. But for a semi-definite program, if you have in a semi-definite program, the positivity constraints are allowed to depend on a continuous parameter. Here I've called it x, but you should think of x as just, we'll just say x is delta. But the key constraint in a semi-definite program is that these positivity constraints have to vary polynomially in this continuous parameter. Here, v is just some vector. You can think of v as minus f unit. So these problems really are almost exactly the same. It's just that above, you can have some very complicated dependence on delta that comes from the form of the conformal blocks. And in the middle, you just want polynomial dependence on delta. So to transform the top problem into a semi-definite program, we need some kind of approximation that lets us replace the conformal blocks with polynomials. In practice, a nice set of linear functionals to consider are just derivatives of the conformal blocks around some point in conformal cross-ratio space. So what we need literally is an approximation for derivatives of conformal blocks in terms of polynomials times some positive function. And if you take this approximation here and plug it in up top, you can cancel out all the chi's. The chi's are just positive, so they don't change any of the positivity constraints. And you're left with a bunch of positivity constraints on polynomials of delta. OK, so we're looking for this kind of funny polynomial approximation for conformal blocks. Are there any questions? OK, so this is a kind of funny ad hoc looking approximation. But what I want to convince you of is that it's actually a beautiful consequence of conformal representation theory. So that's the next part of the talk, where these approximations come from. OK, so a very nice way to think about conformal blocks is in terms of radial quantization. So and a particularly useful way to do this is you can use a conformal transformation to take your four-point function, put all four points on a single two-plane. You can arrange two of the points to lie on the unit circle, and the other two points to lie on some circle of radius r inside the unit circle. And you can think of a conformal block as coming from creating a state with these two operators and then inserting a complete set of states on a circle surrounding them, letting those states propagate out to the final two operators on the unit circle. What this looks like in equations is just you have your four-point function. You arrange the points on these circles, insert your complete set of states. And then the complete set of states can be organized into a sum over primary operators O and a sum over O and all of its descendants, which you get by acting with momentum generators. And the sum over descendants, this stuff here, is precisely the conformal block. OK, so by thinking about conformal blocks in this language, where you have states that are propagating from a circle of radius r out to the unit circle, you can immediately write down a series expression for these conformal blocks that's organized in the energies of these states that are propagating from the inner circle to the outer circle. So each of these states, psi, has energy so here, psi is a bunch of momentum generators acting on a primary operator O. So the energy of psi is equal to the dimension of O plus N, since each momentum generator has energy 1. So there's a factor R to the delta plus N coming from propagating these states from the inner circle to the outer circle. There's some angular dependence, which is given by a Geigenbauer polynomial, this C sub J thing. And then there are coefficients, which are determined by conformal symmetry, and they relate the contribution of the primary operator to all its descendant operators. So this decomposition in terms of conformal blocks follows naturally from this radial quantization picture for them as the sum over states. Here I've written just a few of these coefficients. Let me just point out a few features of these coefficients. So first of all, they're rational functions of delta. This almost immediately gives us what we want. If R is small, then this series expansion converges quickly. So if we want a rational approximation for conformal blocks as a function of delta, we can just truncate the series expansion at some large order. And then each term is a rational function of delta. So the whole thing is some big rational function of delta. So that's good. That's those rational functions. It's almost polynomials. That's the first observation. The second observation is that the denominators in these rational functions are all positive. So for instance, if you look at this term here, that denominator is positive because of the unitarity bound for scalar operators in a CFT, which says that delta is bigger than d minus 2 over 2. And you can see this condition is precisely equivalent to the condition that the denominator there be positive. And if you continue churning out these coefficients, computing them any way you want, you'll find that all the denominators work out to be positive. So this is great. This is actually gives us immediately what we want. We can just take this big series expansion, truncate it at some order, and then all the terms are rational functions with positive denominators, which is what we want. That seems very convenient. But there's actually a nice deep reason why this should be true. And it just comes from looking at the original expression for conformal blocks as a sum over states. You can see explicitly from this expression that poles in the conformal block as a function of delta occur when some state in the sum becomes null. This can't occur above the unitarity bound, precisely because that is the condition that defines the unitarity bound. The unitarity bound is the condition that all descendants of an operator have positive norm. So you're automatically in the regime where none of these states can be null. You can actually go a little farther talking about the structure of these conformal blocks. So the poles where these states become null can occur at very special values of the dimension below the unitarity bound. And there's a nice insight from Zamolodchikov a few decades ago that when a state in when a descendant state becomes null, you actually have many, many states that are becoming null at the same time, because you can take that descendant that becomes null, and also all the states that are built off of it with momentum generators become null as well. So when a single state and this sum becomes null, you actually get an entire conformal multiplet of states that becomes null at the same time. So the contribution from all these null states is a sum over a conformal multiplet. And that is just another conformal block. A sum over a conformal multiplet is a conformal block. So the result is that you can write down an expression for the conformal block in terms of a sum over poles in delta, where each residue is itself a conformal block. And then there's some other term that is an entire function of delta that is easy to determine. And so the result is a recursion relation for conformal blocks that makes very explicit what their pole structure is. And Samolodnikov actually wrote down this recursion relation for Virasoro conformal blocks in two dimensions. And so in that case, is interesting for a number of reasons. One thing about Virasoro blocks is that there aren't any exact expressions for them in general. In 4D, we have nice expressions for conformal blocks under the usual finite dimensional 4D conformal group. But in 2D, there are no nice closed form expressions for Virasoro conformal blocks. And as far as I know, Zamolodnikov's recursion relation is the most efficient way to compute general Virasoro conformal blocks. And so it turns out in these nice coordinates, using this nice radial quantization, you can write down a similar thing for general conformal blocks in any space-time dimension. And the difficult step in writing this down is computing these coefficients, these numerical coefficients, which in principle follow from representation theory. But I don't know how to get them from first principles. What we had to do in practice was compute the conformal block using other means and then kind of experimentally determine these coefficients. So that's, I think that's an interesting, nice problem to figure them out from first principles. And as far as I know, Zamolodnikov didn't actually do this either. In his case, he used his, he made some spectacular guess and then checked it in many cases, and it turned out to be right. So
I thought he later showed that this can be computed by boundary level field theory or something.
Oh, yeah? OK. Great. Maybe you can tell me about that after. Great. OK. So this is very nice. It makes the structure of the blocks completely explicit, and it also immediately gives us the approximation that we need. You can see if you truncate this recursion relation at some number of poles, then you can just pull out a factor, which is manifestly positive, times a polynomial. And that's exactly what we need to apply semi-definite programming. And in practice, also, this recursion relation is the most efficient method for computing conformal blocks that we have. We've had to use a number of different methods in the past using all sorts of different tricks, and this turns out to be the best way to do it. So, so this is everything we need. Are there any questions about the approximation or the recursion relation?
I'm not correctly from the audio computer CIs again.
Yeah, good. So what we did to compute them is we solved the conformal blocks in a series expansion using the conformal Casimir equation to a few orders. And then we sat down in Mathematica and wrote down various guesses that should match these coefficients. And we came up with a guess. And then we checked that guess to 200 orders in the conformal Casimir equation. And it seems to be correct.
So you have a closed expression for this, yeah?
That's correct.
Simple?
Yeah, it's not that bad. It's a product of a bunch of Pockhammers and gammas. And we have it as a function of basically anything you could possibly vary, general external dimensions in the four-point function, general space-time dimension, and it matches. So it seems to be right, but I have no idea how to compute it directly. Any other questions? Yeah?
Does the approximation have to satisfy any, we're trying to satisfy some bound where we care about things being greater than zero, less than zero. Does the approximation have to be always bigger than the true amount or lower than the true amount?
Um, Right. So what we're doing with these polynomials is we're applying linear functionals, which basically means we'll end up taking different linear combinations of these polynomials, and those linear combinations can be both positive and negative. So what we need really is for this approximation to be really good. If it's not really good, then after those linear combinations, you could end up thinking something's positive when in fact it isn't. So the nice thing about this is that it's systematic. And if we want a better approximation, we can just take more and more poles. And in practice, the convergence is quite good. So the value of R that we're actually working with is about 0.17. These delta I move off in the negative direction along negative integers. So if you just take 50 of them, then you get the result correct to within this to the 50th power, which is pretty good. So we can just, in practice, what we do is we just take better and better approximations until the answer stops changing. Any other questions?
So yeah. The original tidyizing model, remind me, so how does the semantic chain programming compare to just the brute force linear programming?
The results are, they're comparable. So semi-definite programming, it's good at sort of the same things and different things than linear programming. In practice, with semi-definite programming, we can get up to about the same number of derivatives as we can with linear programming, but we can do it for larger systems of crossing equations. So I didn't actually say this, but in an ON theory, the system of crossing relations is bigger. I just gave the example of a singlet, but for a theory with ON symmetry, the four-point function gets contributions from all the representations that can appear in the operator product expansion. So the crossing symmetry actually relates many different representations to each other, and so you get a bigger system of equations. Semi-definite programming, we found in practice, works very well on these large systems of equations, but it can only go up to sort of the same number of derivatives. So in practice, the bounds we get on the 3D icing model are about the same as what we're getting with linear programming, but the bounds on ON models are way better.
The ON model could not do with linear programming, right?
Pardon?
The ON model you could not do with linear programming.
So it's in principle it is a linear program. If you apply the same tricks, the key problem is we have these positivity constraints that depend on a continuous parameter. You have to discretize that parameter. So you can use linear programming to attack the ON models. The problem is that the systems of equations that you have are really big. So when we apply semi-definite programming, we're searching over a space of linear functionals that is 165 dimensional. And in linear programming, the best we've been able to do is get up to 40, 50 dimensional. Other questions? Okay. Great. So let me show you what happens when you put all these things together. So this is the analog of the plot that I started with for ON models. So this is a plot of the dimension of phi versus the dimension of phi squared, which is the lowest dimension singlet in the phi phi OPE. And each of these is an upper bound. And they're labeled for the various theories that they apply to. And there are a few other things on this plot. So firstly, the black crosses are the values of operator dimensions that you get using large N perturbation theory for the ON models for N equals 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, and so on. So the accumulation point at infinite n is delta phi equals 1/2 and delta phi squared equals 2. And you can see that the approximations, the large N approximations, work very well. They're very close to the kinks in each of these plots from the O20 model and O10 model. And the dashed line interpolates between the large N solutions. So the dashed line, I just took the large N calculation, which was at two or three loops, and I just made N a continuous parameter. And the whole point is just so you can see that the approximation becomes not so good at small values of N. So the other things in this plot are error bars. And these error bars show the errors in the values of these dimensions coming from Monte Carlo simulations, the epsilon expansion, and in the case of the O2 model, also experiment. You can see that for small n, they're pretty good. They agree very nicely with the position of the kinks on each of these curves. One of the things about Monte Carlo simulations is that they get harder as n gets bigger, because you literally have n states at each site on the lattice. So you have a bigger and bigger system as n gets bigger. So the error bars get worse. But for us, n is just a parameter. We can make it whatever we like. And it seems that the literature is not so good for the O5 and O6 models. There's another technique that is determining these error bars, which is called the exact renormalization group. And it's not rigorous. And I think what we have here is evidence that previous techniques are not correctly estimating at least the dimension of delta phi squared in the O5 and O6 model. So altogether, it's a pretty nice picture. From all the best evidence we have, the ON models are really saturating these bounds coming from the conformal bootstrap. Are there any questions about this plot?
So just want to say for the O6 and O5, so you expect the actual value to be closer to the slope?
Yeah, kind of the upper right. Yeah, exactly. So these kinks.
Vertical bar is not allowed to.
Pardon?
So the vertical level bar, you think is just not correct?
I think it's not correct. Yeah, that's right.
So are these kinks?
Right, so they're kind of smooth-ish. Let me point out, actually, if you notice the difference in scale between the x-axis and the y-axis, if you make the scale more equal, then they are very, very sharp. But here they look kind of smooth. What's going into these bounds is we have to make a choice of the space of linear functionals we search in. So in the example I did on the board, I searched in a one-dimensional space of linear functionals. I just said, I'm only going to consider second derivatives around this point. In general, what we have to do is say, I'm going to consider derivatives up to 10 derivatives around some point. And the more derivatives you consider, the better bounds you get. In practice, we found that for the 3D icing model, if we do, say, 10 derivatives, if we zoom in on the kink there, with 10 derivatives, we get some kind of smooth curve. And with more and more derivatives, the kink gets sharper and sharper. We're getting better at doing the 3D icing model. The kink is getting sharper and sharper. So the indications from numerics are that if we could do better for the ON models, these should be sharper features. One interesting thing that we are finding, though, when this occurs, is that although the kink is getting sharper, the actual value of the bound at the kink itself doesn't change, not very much. So it's somehow like the theory is living there. It's preventing the bound from going below the theory, but the bound can change everywhere else. Other questions? You can play the same game with other CFT quantities. So this is an example of bounds on the dimension of phi I phi j, which is the symmetric tensor in the phi phi OPE. And you can also put upper bounds on its dimension. These are somewhat less studied in the condensed matter literature. They do have a name. These dimensions are called crossover exponents. But because they're less studied, I think they're computed at a lower loop order in the epsilon expansion, and so the error bars are larger for small n theories. And in fact, the error bars for the O5 theory don't even intersect our O5 curve, which is in green. Again, the calculations from large n perturbation theory look pretty good compared to the bootstrap bounds. Yes?
So do the dimensions of the current flavor currents enter?
So the flavor currents are antisymmetric tensors.
Right, so they're not entering
this. Yeah, right. So circle. Yeah, so I don't have a plot for those guys. But let's see.
So
I guess
don't input the fact that there are.
No, we don't. We don't input that. If we knew the coefficients of the two-point function of the flavor current, then we could put that in, and that would be great.
You could type vary it and the bounds of that.
Right, exactly. So I think the best approach we could do here would be to put bounds on that two-point function coefficient, and a natural conjecture coming from all of this is that the actual values of the OPE coefficients and operator dimensions saturate the bounds that you get from these techniques. So that would be a way to guess that two-point function coefficient.
So n here is just a continuous parameter, right?
That's right. Yeah. So we could, for instance, try to we could put bounds on theories with fractional values of n. Those theories actually, there's a nice argument by Maldacena and Zhibodov, where they show that at least at large n, theories with fractional values of n are not unitary. And they do this by explicitly constructing operators which have a negative norm when n is fractional. And that argument works at large n, and I would guess that the spirit of the argument shows that we shouldn't expect fractional n theories to make sense at small n either.
Yeah, we just need to see some other conserved currents. I guess everything is smooth as variant.
Yeah, everything is smooth. Yeah, so you wouldn't see anything special here at large n and at fractional n. And one thing about their construction is that the operators that they construct have order n fields in them. So they have very, very large dimension. So we wouldn't be very sensitive to them. Their contribution to this OPE would be quite small. So it kind of makes sense that these results are smooth, and they don't see that. Good. So we have access to symmetric tensor dimensions, and these look pretty good compared with the error bars and large n expansion. And you can also compute other quantities. So this is an example of the coefficient of the two-point function of the stress tensor in this theory, which is the usually called the central charge. These are lower bounds on the central charge of each of these theories, normalized by the central charge of n free bosons. Here you can see very nicely that we're agreeing with the large n expansion. In the large n expansion, the central charge just becomes a linear function of the dimension of phi at very, very large n, and we're matching the slope of that function exactly, or exactly to within numerical errors. A lot of nice results coming from this, and if you're very optimistic, you can take these results and turn them into actual predictions for all of these values. A natural assumption that one could make, and we're seeing a lot of evidence for it, is that the actual values of the operator dimensions and OPE coefficients in these theories they saturate the bounds coming from the bootstrap. And if you assume this is true, then you can write down predictions for these various operator dimensions and central charges. And this is a big heap of numbers. You don't have to absorb this all, but I just want to emphasize that these are actual numerical predictions for strongly coupled non-perturbative theories coming from the CFT bootstrap. And this is really the only rigorous way that we have to approach these numbers. So this is really exciting. Are there any more questions? Anyone want to quibble with any of the digits? Okay, so let me just, since I have a little bit of time, let me flash another plot for you guys that falls into this story. This is from another recent paper with a number of collaborators. And here we were looking at another family of theories that contains the 3D icing model. So in addition to looking at ON models, you can think of the 3D icing model as being as lying on the family of Wilson-Fisher fixed points. So you can start in four dimensions, in 4 minus epsilon dimensions, there's a conformal field theory. Phi 4 is conformal in 4 minus epsilon dimensions. And if you imagine continuing epsilon to 1, then you get a conformal field theory in 3 dimensions. And indications are that this is this theory is the same as the 3D icing model. And people have tried to compute operator dimensions in the 3D icing model by doing Feynman diagram computations in the epsilon expansion and then setting epsilon equal to 1. And it seems to work OK, although you get effects like the three-loop result is bigger than the two-loop result. The expansion obviously breaks down at some point. Our understanding of these theories has been kind of vague for a while. They make sense when epsilon is infinitesimal, and we can do perturbation calculations for Wilson-Fisher fixed points. But we haven't really had a non-perturbative definition of these theories. But you can do the conformal bootstrap in fractional spacetime dimensions. And the way this proceeds is exactly the same as everything that I said earlier in the talk. And there's a natural definition for conformal blocks in fractional spacetime dimension that just comes from the fact that we have this series expansion where each term is a rational function. And I emphasize that they were rational functions of delta, but they're also rational functions of the spacetime dimension. So that because we have rational functions, they have a natural analytic continuation to fractional values of the dimension. So this recursion relation gives a natural definition of fractional dimensional conformal blocks. And then you can go and put bounds on operator dimensions in fractional dimensional theories. And each of the bounds that you get looks just the same as everything I've been plotting. It starts rising up. It has some kink. And then it goes off to the upper right. If you put points on each of the kinks and interpolate, you get some curve. And the curve has a lot of nice properties. For one, it agrees with the free theory in four dimensions. So actually, I should say what these labels are. So what I'm labeling here are the anomalous dimensions of these fields. So gamma, did I call it gamma sigma? Gamma sigma is the dimension of sigma minus what we would expect in a free theory. And gamma epsilon is the dimension of epsilon minus what we would expect in a free theory. So in a free theory, exactly in a free theory, which is what we have in four dimensions, they should both be zero. This line of Wilson-Fisher fixed points is supposed to interpolate all the way to two dimensions, where we should get the values of these anomalous dimensions in the 2D icing model. And indeed, we do. So there's this point here, 1/8, 1, which exactly agrees with the operator dimensions of the 2D icing model. And then meanwhile, there's a whole curve. And you can look at the curve for very small deviations from four dimensions. and the points agree with what you get in the epsilon expansion very nicely. So what this plot is kind of showing is that there could be some non-perturbative definition of these fractional dimensional CFTs, where you think of them as a set of CFT data of dimensions and spins and OPE coefficients that satisfy unitarity and crossing. And that set of data makes sense. So there's some continuous parameter that continuous family that contains these nice theories, like the 3D Ising model, the 2D Ising model, and the free theory in four dimensions. And it actually makes sense non-perturbatively, not just at the level of Feynman diagrams. For the bootstrap, the exciting thing about this plot is that, again, the theories that we know about seem to live right at the kink on each of these plots. And this is useful and interesting information that we could try to use to actually solve these theories.
So is the tricritical fixed point visible below t equals 3? You have also 5 to the 6.
Right. So that's a good question. So in order to see other theories, we need to, there aren't any other kinks on each of these curves. So in order to see other theories, what we probably need to do is put in assumptions that restrict us to those class of theories. So for example, you could ask, so in the plot that I've been calling the Ising model plot, it actually applies to ON models as well, because ON models also have a scalar. You could just take one component of the N scalars, and you could ask about the OPE of that one component with itself. And so the 3D Ising plot looks like this, and it applies to all CFTs in three dimensions, and the ON models live below it somewhere. In order to actually see these theories, we need to put in more assumptions. Those assumptions have to rule out the 3D Ising model, which is up here, but allow the ON models. And the assumption we put in practice is ON symmetry. So if you put in that there's O2 symmetry, then you get a different curve, and then the O2 model actually appears. So in the case of the tricritical Ising model, what we would need is some assumption that forces us to be to look at theories that are like the tricritical Ising model. So for instance, you could try to put in Z3 symmetry. And in the case of this particular four-point function we're looking at, I'm not sure how that helps you. But if you had systems of four-point functions, many different four-point functions, then Z3 symmetry would constrain the various OPE coefficients. And you might hope that studying those systems, you could then see kinks and plots that correspond to the tricritical Ising model. Does that make sense? So there's a principle that we're kind of arriving at in our current work on the bootstrap, which is that so there's a simple characterization of the theories at each of these kinks that seems to work from the numerics, which is that these are theories that minimize the central charge of among all theories in the class you're considering. So the central charge is related to the OPE coefficient of the stress tensor by lambda stress tensor is delta phi squared over the central charge. So in practice, what you can do to try to get to the theory at the kink is consider all solutions to crossing consistent with unitarity that maximize this coefficient. It's the squared. So try to maximize this coefficient. And if you do that, you arrive at the kink. This is still somewhat conjectural. We're trying to accumulate evidence for this. But what it would mean is that what you would need to do to see the tricritical Ising model is find some assumption that restricts you to a class of solutions to crossing, such that the tricritical icing model is the one that maximizes that coefficient.
Is this still on the border?
Say that again?
Is tricritical icing model still on the border of your...
That's a good question. I don't think so. So, for actually, in two space-time dimensions, it is very close to the border. But I actually don't know. I don't know about other dimensions between 2 and 3. Yeah?
You've been mentioning mostly the kink, but I was wondering about these curves, like the one that arrives at the kink and the other one.
Yeah.
Can you understand them analytically somehow, or?
Are they flat,
or I mean, I can't see well from the picture. Is this a line or some curve?
Good. So we have some partial understanding of these curves, which is I'll just redraw my. So in two space-time dimensions, there's a construction of one of these curves analytically. So in two space-time dimensions, the bound looks like this, and this is at the 2D icing model. There are other theories that we know about in two dimensions, namely minimal models, which so as central charge go to one, accumulate, and they all kind of live along a line in the space. So there's in the appendix of a paper by Restelli, Beam, and Van Rees, they construct a class of four-point functions that interpolates between the four-point functions of the 2D icing model and these various minimal models, with a continuous parameter, which you can think of as just the central charge. So they wrote down a four-point function, a minimal model four-point function with the central charge as a parameter. So this four-point function could never be the four-point function in a unitary CFT in two dimensions, because we know that only for these special values of the central charge can the theory be unitary. But from the point of view of this analysis, we're using a kind of restricted definition of unitarity. Just the only definition we're using is that the OPE coefficients squared be positive. And this four-point function does have that property. So even though there are negative norm states appearing in the OPE, they're summing up so that their total contribution, when expressed in terms of SL2 conformal blocks, still has positive coefficients. So anyway, so there's a line of four-point functions that interpolates between these guys. And because of that line, the bound could never go below it. So, and in fact, the bound seems to be converging toward it. So we have an analytic expression for what the bound should look like above the 2D icing model.
So what about the region to the left? What prevents decreasing the bound?
Here.
Yeah.
So we're not. The construction doesn't work to the left, because if you move to the left, then you actually do get a negative OPE coefficient squared if you take your parameter and move it to the left. So you can't continue along this line. You need some other class of four-point functions, and we don't know what they are.
That line might change with your approximation.
Yes, that's right. We also don't know exactly what the optimal line is. Yeah, as we do a better approximation, as we look at more and more derivatives, then the line keeps moving down.
There might be nothing eventually there holding it, but we're not. I mean,
saying it could be this, like a step function, maybe. I mean
the other side is kept in place by the fact that there are actually models.
Right.
Keeping it from going too much down, but on that region, do you know of anything?
Right, well, so in 3D, the ON models actually do that, because the ON models, they live kind of at various points along here. And the reason they do that is because, so we're looking at the lowest dimension scalar in the OPE. Actually, let me see. So what is that scalar in the ON model? It's not phi squared, it's phi I phi j. Because so in the way to put the ON models on this plot is to pick any real scalar operator. So in particular, let's pick a single component, phi 1. And then we're looking at the phi 1, phi 1 OPE, and that contains both phi squared and phi I phi j. And phi I phi j has a lower dimension than phi squared. Phi squared has dimension close to 2 for large n theories, whereas phi I phi j has dimension close to 1. So you get a series of points where delta phi is moving towards the unitarity bound, and delta phi I phi j is moving down. So you have a bunch of points there. And those will support the curve in 3D.
So yeah. In the 3D case, the tire four-point function of Castellanova, it's an approximation function, something like that.
Right.
Have you tried to find to tune the parameters to fit this other?
In other dimensions.
Yes.
That's no, I haven't tried that. Yeah, that would be very nice.
Even in 2D, it's not the exact curve, right? It's just some curve that goes.
Well, it's
so in 2D, it's conjecturally equal to the optimal bound. If we were to make the numerics better and better, then our bound would move to this line.
That cannot, okay. Yeah, below that, it cannot be better.
It can't possibly go below it. So yeah, I mean, if we had an analytic continuation of this family to fractional space-time dimensions, then we would have a definite prediction for the 3D IC model, which would be very nice.
But it's probably not go all the way to the IC model, because hopefully the Kofun function IC model itself is not an approximate function. But
yeah. Hopefully, yeah, I guess so. It depends.
But might,
good. So. Okay, so I'll just, I should wrap up. So this is a very young subject. There's a lot to do. And here are just a few natural other directions to go. One, and I mentioned this a little bit, considering systems of four-point functions of many different operators. So for example, in the 3D icing model, all we considered was just sigma, 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 but you could try to look at sigma, sigma, epsilon, epsilon, and epsilon, 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 all together, use the fact that OPE coefficients that appear in one correlator also appear in another correlator, and they're all related to each other. And you might hope that all these relations together could give stronger bounds. You can also look at not just systems of scalars, but you can look at other kinds of operators. So a natural class to look at would be symmetry currents and stress tensors. And this is very technically challenging, as far as we know currently. For one, the crossing relations, well, so for example, Anatoly Demarsky has been working on classifying four-point functions of stress tensors, and I think his latest findings are that the number of structures, tensor structures that can appear in a four-point function of stress tensors is somewhere around like 100 or something, or 50 or 100, something terrible. For scalars, it's just one structure. So that's a much bigger problem. But on the other hand, it's a very nice problem to consider because every theory has a stress tensor. And it would be lovely to try to get very general results about any CFT just using the fact that it has a stress tensor. And there's been a lot of interesting work on getting bounds on things involving stress tensors. There's conformal collider physics paper by Hoffman and Maldacena, for example, where they consider three-point functions of stress tensors, and they get a lot of mileage out of that. So that would be very interesting. You could also look at other space-time dimensions. or more supersymmetry. So I think you heard in the spring about work done on the, being done on the superconformal bootstrap. That's a very interesting direction to go. You could try to look at Suzy theories in three dimensions, which no one has done yet. There's also lots of interesting lore. There's one interesting piece of lore about very high dimensional CFTs, which is that they shouldn't exist. And it would be nice to know whether we could say something about that question. Finally, it would be lovely to connect the conformal bootstrap to ADS CFT more directly to know if there's some ADS some way to understand from ADS where these positivity conditions are coming from. I'm not so sure about this line now because the bootstrap seems to be its strongest for small n theories, and ADS CFT works best for large n theories. On the other hand, we were seeing good predictions from the bootstrap for large n ON models. So it may be that there's some, maybe in the case of the ON models, there's some analytic understanding that you could get by looking at the crossing relations at large n and trying to use bootstrap techniques. And in general, it would be very nice to improve our analytic understanding of all of this stuff and get away from all this complicated numerics. So that's it. Thank you.
More questions?
Yes.
So just because you're not mentioning it, I would like to ask you what do you think about, as for future direction of the bootstrap, a recent paper by Ferdinando Iozzi, who used your techniques, but applying them, I don't know if you don't know that paper, he applied the techniques of conformal bootstrap to specific models instead for finding generic bounds, using the fact that for a specific model you know the fusion rules, and he was able to without numerics, so with a very low degree of precision, as for what can be possible for the conformal bootstrap, but high precision with respect to numerical result to determine the scaling dimension in those models' numbers. So in that case, the basic stuff was just truncating the series of the equations to a certain point and find out zero of the determinant.
Right. I'm aware of this paper. I don't want to say too much about it because honestly, I don't understand it very well. As far as I do understand, he does also do a truncation of the crossing relation to some number of derivatives. And I think, so to get more precise results, that you'd have to take that truncation to involve more and more derivatives. And it's not clear to me that the techniques he proposes will scale better than these techniques. So in this case, to get really good results, to get higher precision, we need many, many derivatives. With what he's doing, I think if he had many derivatives, it would also be a comparably difficult problem to what we're solving here.
Well, it's a different problem, right? So your aim is much more ambitious. So you're finding bounds for general CFTs. It's the problem, as far as I understand, at least.
Right.
The problem which is tackled in that paper is
specific.
Restrict. So you just look at specific theories and you try to get numbers out of a set of equations, finding out that the determinant should be zero.
Right.
And that determines some scale dimensions, but obviously it doesn't know anything about what's around that theory, but it knows quite well what is inside that theory, so it could maybe be a future direction to that.
Yeah, maybe. I don't understand how he's looking at specific theories. Mm-hmm. So so I can't say much more about it.
Okay. So just asking an opinion.
Sure.
Other questions?
Let's think.